As always, I am Carter Spires, here with my co-host Matthew Bartlett, the owner and managing editor of The Roost, your premier source for Rice sports news and analysis. Coming off a week that's, it just feels like we're taking those old records off the shelf over and over again at this point in some respects.
What is that, radio, the song that comes on at Groundhog Day when he wakes up? I hear that playing in the background.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not quite. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, in the macro sense, there are a lot of similarities. In the micro sense, there is at least some rather one thing in particular, I think, that is probably pretty interesting to talk about for this game. We will hit some housekeeping stuff, some more Rice sports news, and some CUSA talk before we get into the game itself. So,
yeah, lots of stuff going around South Main and the Roost this week. So. First off, if you haven't yet wanted to plug this again, become a member of the site. It's free. You can go ahead and register. There's links all over. This week as kind of a post-game look back at the offense under new starting quarterback, or at least last game's starting quarterback, Giovanni Johnson, broke down a drive chart of his games and kind of what the offense looked like with him at the helm. That is exclusively for members of the site. That's free, but you do got to go ahead and create an account and log in and join the discussion. We'd love to know what you think. And then as of course, we appreciate everybody who has gone ahead and give us a review and the feedback we have received so far. If you'd like to, please go find us on iTunes or wherever else you listen to podcasts. If you're not an Apple person, confession, I'm not. It's okay.
Neither am I.
There you go. Well, we might be a rarity. You can find two people on this earth that don't do Apple.
Yeah, this is Windows Android Windows Android podcast.
There you go. We're making a stand.
Yeah.
Starting now, the Roost podcast, pro Android. There you go. So if you are on Android, I promise you can still find it. Google Play, Google Podcast, Spotify, what have you. But wherever you listen, we'd love to hear from you. And if you'd leave us a review, that helps us out a lot. And then moving on to a couple Rice notes for the week outside of the gridiron, we have basketball and volleyball. Both the men's and the women's basketball teams got their first official game under their belts on, I guess, Tuesday of this week. The men went to the road and played Arkansas and did not fare too well, lost 91-43 and shot 8% from three, which is a not how they are going to try and get some wins. That's a little bit hard to do, shooting 8% for three from the road. Not so great, but good news. The women's team was at home, and they won 71-47. And there are 14 players on the roster, and all 14 of them played in that game. 12 of them scored points, and 12 of them had rebounds. It's always nice to open up your bench, particularly early. This game was over midway through the second quarter, and we got to see a lot of every freshman get some run, and some other folks score in addition to Nancy Mulkey and Erica Oguike. So that was pretty
Haley
fun.
Swayze had a great shooting night, didn't she?
Yeah, she started out 4-for-6 from three in the first half, which of course prompted me to go ahead and look up the all-time record for the Rice women. 3 points made in a game was 7. But as I said, because of them emptying out the bench, she was one of the first women off of on the floor after the starters kind of gave way. But of course, then she gave way to some other people on the third and the fourth rotations. So, you know, maybe if we see her play more than I don't know how many minutes she actually ended up getting. But once we see a full rotation, it would be nice to see her get close to breaking or at least tying that record. And of course, the last Rice player to have 6 threes in a game was Nicole Adamarco, who did it twice last year. So Rice looking for a sharpshooter on the outside, maybe it would be Haley Swayze. It was her birthday this week as well, so a good birthday present is starting out the season on the win. So happy birthday to you, Haley, and congrats to the Rice women.
Yeah, in case any other teams in the conference thought that the Rice was going to take their foot off your necks this season, sorry, it ain't happening.
Oh, and this is an aside from being at the game. I appreciate, so Rice was playing Nicholls State, which is, I'm guessing, not terribly far of a drive from Louisiana, but it's still a trip for a midweek game. So yeah, I appreciate all fans that are willing to make their trip out to a road game, particularly if it's in an Olympic sport or something that's not one of the, you know, college football crazies. So kudos there. But there was a Nicholls State fan sitting behind the scoring bench where I was at watching the game, which at one point the Owls had passed the ball inside to Nancy Mulkey, who is all of 10'14". And there was a point guard on the other team, or a guard of some sort, who was 5'5", trying to guard her. And the fan behind us kept yelling, "Get your hands up, get your hands up, get your hands up," as if a 5'5" guard getting their hands up would be able to do anything to stop. Yeah,
as in, like, get your hands Mulkey up and maybe try to slap her in the face to break her concentration or something like that, because that...
Exactly. Like, I'm short. I've walked by Nancy and looked up, and she's very good at basketball, and there's nothing I could do. It was a several-minute chant of, you know, A for effort. But that ended as expected. And then for those who haven't yet looked at their calendars or cleared their calendars, the volleyball team is in action this weekend on Sunday in a game that, you know, diehard volleyball fan or not, this is one that you'll want to be at on Sunday. They play Western Kentucky. Both teams right now undefeated in conference play, 10-0. A piece. Rice is 21-1. Western Kentucky is 24-1. They're the only two ranked teams in Conference USA. And this one has, if that wasn't enough, this one has some special value because Western Kentucky had a 57-game conference winning streak at home that Rice went in and snapped last season. So they were the first team in years to beat Western Kentucky on their home court, and Western will be out looking for revenge, and Rice will look to continue their streak of perfection, which not many people have tested them so far. So this should be a battle, and it should be pretty fun.
And also, like, I think, so Rice beat Texas earlier in the season, and now isn't Texas up to their rank number one or something like that, and only have two
they
losses?
Are number one, yes.
Yeah. So
losses.
It's a pretty good team. It's a pretty decent volleyball team we're looking at here. So,
yes, at this point, rankings come out, I think, Mondays, and every week Rice climbs higher and higher and higher. This is kind of like the basketball team, the women last year. Of, you know, at some point they might not respect Rice, but somebody's going to lose, and then lo and behold, they're pretty darn good.
Yeah, I was actually I was surprised to realize. I guess I didn't take note when the preseason poll came out. I was a little peeved to note that the Rice women weren't ranked coming into this year in basketball, you know, considering that they ended the season ranked last year and then got almost
better.
Everybody except almost got everybody back. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely ridiculous. But I have a hunch that should they beat Texas A&M in a couple of weeks at Tudor Fieldhouse, that will turn around rather quickly. So lots of good Rice things, and then a couple of Conference USA things before we get into Rice football-specific stuff where we will camp out. FAU knocked off Western Kentucky this past weekend, and with Marshall beating Rice, that sets up those two teams with kind of in the driver's seat and in the East. They have 4-1 apiece, and you know, those were kind of the two teams, along with maybe FIU, that were kind of projected to be in the running at the beginning of the season. And lo and behold, we're, I guess, 2/3-ish of the way through conference play. That's where they're set up. On the other side, there is one undefeated team, or other one team undefeated in conference play so far, and that is Louisiana Tech. They were off last weekend, obviously could not lose, and they're sitting alone at 4-0 in the West. And then we got an interesting two-way tie, UAB and Southern Miss playing around there. So UAB still with a chance to play them and give them a run. So the conference races are starting to come down to the last couple teams, and should be an interesting couple of weeks. A lot of those big games are backloaded in the schedule, so it's going to be till late November when we see some of the bigger games in the conference. So that's something to keep an eye on. And then on the other side, if we want to bring it back around to where Rice sits, Rice, for the record, is one of three winless teams in Conference USA. Old Dominion and Bobby Wilder, their coach, I think when they were 1-6, said that this was the best 1-6 team in the nation. They are now 1-8. So Rice sitting at 0-9. We don't know. Rice might be the best 0-9. Old Dominion will give them the best 1-8. I sure would like the chance to play Old Dominion against this year if we had the option. So, but UTEP, 0-5, the third winless team in conference. They are 1-7. They is the final game for Rice this year. And Carter, I don't know if you saw this. It took them all of like 26 seconds to be losing 14-0 to North Texas this weekend.
That's not good. That's an achievement in some senses. Like that takes, it's an achievement. Let's say that.
It is something. UTEP would go on to score 26 in 60 minutes after allowing 14 in 30 seconds, and it did not go well for them. But that's kind of where we're at. We got some good teams. We got teams that are still looking for that first win in conference, and brings us to Rice, which unfortunately is still in that group.
Yeah. Like I said at the outset, this game, kind of in a macro sense, is exactly what we've seen all year. The defense performed about as well overall, as far as what you could reasonably expect. They definitely allowed guys to get behind them a little more than you would have liked to have seen, which was disappointing after they have mostly not allowed that to happen this year. But at the same time, you know, they gave up 20 points, so you're not going to complain about that performance on the whole. It was good to see the pass rush get home a little bit more than they have in recent weeks. So that was a positive development on the defensive front. And, you know, they are still missing Andrew Berg and starting true freshman Trayshawn DeVos, who had a good game. But, you know, yeah, all things considered, you're not disappointed with that defensive effort, I don't think.
No. I mean, it's get to the point where you're asking good to be great and great to be whatever is better than great. My brain is not working at a Rice level as we record, but I think it was interesting because we've seen this before where, you know, Marshall was able to basically use a couple big plays, including a 63-yard bomb from Isaiah Green down the field to the 1-yard line where they were able to punch it in for a 1-yard touchdown. It was the only rushing touchdown that they had on the day, even though Brendan Knox had a pretty good game on the ground. But aside from that one big play and a couple others, they were able to move down the field. Rice had a blocked field goal in this game and was pretty stingy, 2-for-4 in the red zone. And after halftime, allowed 3 points. And we kind of saw this story play out against Baylor. And really, it's been pretty common that the Rice defense has been able to do well, like well enough. If we had the same performance in both halves, we'd be okay. But they've been able to consistently get better after halftime and make those adjustments and make those changes to where, yeah, Rice was losing by, what was that, 10 points at the break, but only gave up 3 more. This was a game that was a 2-score game through its entire duration. And had Rice been able to answer with a big play or two of their own, which I think went on, Giovanni had several, just couldn't stay healthy and finish the game. It was a game that never got too far away, which is what the defense has done consistently every game this year.
Yeah, you know, and if you take a step back and look at the, even just the results in conference play. Like, if you had told me before the season the Rice defense was going to give up, in order in conference play, 23 points in overtime, 35 points, 31 points, 20 points, 20 points. Like, I would have been ecstatic with that. Like, that's, you know, given sort of an average offensive performance to pair with those set of results as far as defensive points allowed, you pretty much take that every time. And, you know, I was thinking about, not to keep harping on the schedule thing, but like I was thinking about earlier this week, if you just swapped the schedules of this year's team and last year's team, so that this year Rice was playing the 2019 versions of all the teams they played in 2018, they won two games against that slate last year. This team definitely beats, or you feel pretty good about their chances of beating Prairie View and Old Dominion. Probably beat UTEP, hopefully, maybe. They
probably beat Hawaii.
Yeah. I mean, they
improve like, secondary play. You get UTSA and you get UTEP both at home.
You're getting minimum three wins against that slate. You're with a decent shot at four, an outside shot at maybe five. So, like, you know, it just goes to show how much the teams that you play and how that reflects itself in your record can shape the narrative so much. Because think about if the schedules are reversed and last year's team goes 1-12, I mean, whatever, how is that a whole lot different than what did happen last year? Or it goes 1-11, I guess, against the 12-game schedule. And this team goes, what, 4-9, 5-8, maybe, against a 13-game schedule? You know, now the narrative coming out of this season is, wow, you know, Rice really took a step forward. They, you know, first year was a year zero. They didn't get a lot of wins, but in year two, we saw some proof of concept, and they, you know, got some improvement, or maybe looking at shooting for a bowl next year. And instead, we're sitting here late in year two, staring at 0-9. So
yeah, which Rice fans will understand with statistics and variance that sometimes the process and the results are not in sync. That you know, you can have the right process and get bad results, and there are outliers and things that happen. I think you might have seen this. I retweeted it from the Roost account this week on Twitter. The Bill Connolly did a S&P Plus, or what are we now, SP Plus?
Yeah, corrected. Yeah, we'll drop the ampersand for legal
Standard
reasons.
And Poor. sorry, I didn't get confused, but now we won't. The SP Plus comparisons of second year head coaches in FBS from year one to year two, and using his metrics, which would put a lot of pieces that go into building out to that number, but Rice is better per the SP plus than they were last year, which I think when you watch the team play, if you just took watched a game regardless of the result from the 2018 team to the 2019 team, I think it would be pretty apparent, especially on defense. But because of the very, you know, discrete results of wins and losses, it doesn't always look that way.
Right. And this is not like, you know, an MLB season where you get 162 games to have your record eventually fall in line with your team quality. The thing about college football that defines it so much, which I think so few people when they talk about it really tend to take into account, is that the sample sizes are so, so, so small. Which, to go on a slight tangent, is why metrics like SP Plus exist. Because if you want to get real objective measures of team quality, you need to take every data point you can get. Which is why looking at wins and losses is not really going to tell you a whole lot about team quality. It's kind of a secondary property. You need to get as granular as possible and judge things on a play-by-play basis and look at it. Take as many data points as you possibly can, because if you're just looking at it on a game-by-game basis, the results of games are just not, it's just not enough data points.
Not enough, yeah. Because variance is fun, and this is why we love and we hate college football. I mean, you can, if it's your cup of tea and you want to go watch, what, the Cincinnati Bengals and the Miami Dolphins go play on Sunday. I think that this game is coming up in a week, so you go for it. But even if you're talking differences from the upper echelon of the NFL to the bottom tiers, like the talent gap or the quality gap is not as severe, and you can kind of terse things out. And a lot of teams in the NFL, most of them end up somewhere stuck between 10-6, 6-10, around 500 in the bell curve.
Yeah.
And college football is all over the place from conference to conference and across the board, and that's how we get these crazy upsets and weird stuff happen, and that's why we love it when things continuously break your way. I think we've already referenced the Auburn ridiculousness and luck on this podcast before, so we won't go back. But there are occasions where things continuously don't break your way, and I think Bryce is closer to that line of luck and good fortune than the latter. So
yeah, if you want to talk about a more contemporary example of extreme luck, for those of you who are you know, bigger fans of the sport at large, Minnesota this season, I think everybody realizes what a good story there are. They're 8-0, so they won their first, like, I guess the Big Ten plays 9 conference games, so their first three or four games, and including their out of conference schedule, were like all one score games that they managed to pull out like at the very last second,
and against like South Dakota, and like not a murderer's row, a really soft...
Well, they picked a slate of teams that were not like world beaters, but were all in the category of, dear God, why would you schedule that team? Like, it was like Georgia Southern and Fresno State, like two really good, really pesky group of five teams, like from a power five perspective, the kinds that just like totally screw with you.
It's a pretty admirable quality to refer to as a group of five team. Like, pesky is a badge of honor.
Yeah. And then a South Dakota State team, like them and North Dakota State are the ones that, like, you know, if you're a Big Ten, Big 12 team and you're not like a Ohio State type talented, you don't schedule those schools because those are the top tier FCS schools, and they will absolutely beat you in your own house and take your million dollar check in the process. So they somehow skated through that early schedule, and then their last like five games, they played backup quarterbacks in every single one.
So where's the stretch where Rice gets to play backup quarterbacks in five straight games?
Yeah, I know.
Please? We're working on it. Anyhow, schedule aside, we've been there, and we know it's tough. We will have by again, wins and losses, not the end all be all, but should be a bit less rigorous the rest of the way with Middle Tennessee, North Texas, and UTEP than it has been. And Rice has held their own, especially again on the defensive side of the ball, and a lot of promise from the offense, which I think is as good a place to start as any if we're going to jump into kind of the more intricacies of the Marshall game.
Yeah. So obviously Giovanni Johnson got the start. He was 10 of 17 for 97 yards and a touchdown through the air, which is, I don't know, it's not great, not terrible. It's certainly better than Tom Stewart's 1 of 9 for 6 yards, which is a line that I'm just looking at for the first time. And I don't want to give Tom too much crap coming off that back injury and being pressed into action.
Yeah,
at the end
he was
of the
playing
game,
at 20%,
yeah,
maybe.
I mean,
and Giovanni did start, I believe, 8 of 9 for like 87 yards or something like that. So not much better start in the first half than the second half. And I think something that we need to keep into perspective when we talk about Giovanni is that line for a quarterback, not wonderful, just above 50% and less than 100 yards passing. He also ran for 85 yards on the ground before you take away sacks, which is something that Rice has not had from their quarterback for a good long while.
And that passing line doesn't sound impressive, but if you look at his quarterback, his unadjusted quarterback rating, and this is ESPN's proprietary stat, and ESPN can be a little frustrating with their metrics like this because they're very opaque about, and QBR is actually one of the better ones in this regard because they at least give you some idea of what the inputs are. It's based in expected points added, which is their a very good metric that a lot of good analysts that do work at all levels of football put a lot of stock in, but it sort of totals up the EPA for rushing and passing and penalties, and then adjusts it for the amount of plays you run and stuff like that. So, and it's on a 0 to 100 scale. Giovanni's QBR was 56.5 in this game, which is not like stellar, but I think it's better than any Rice QB has put up this season, except for like Tom Stewart in limited action in the Baylor game.
Yeah, I want to say we were talking about QBRs in the 20s and 30s a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. There have been plenty of those. So 56.5 isn't world beating, but it's about the top end of what we've seen from Rice quarterbacks this season. So for him to come in and be doing that as a true freshman. And a lot of that is based in the value he added as a rusher, but those yards count just the same as the passing yards do. I mean, you know, ask a Baltimore Ravens fan this season if they feel feel any worse because their QB is getting a lot of yards on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, and I think another thing that the QBR can only take into account of so much, and this the piece I broke down, I was really curious. I went drive by drive, and the piece that's up for members on the site, and it was really interesting. So the first drive, Brad Rosner got flagged for offensive pass interference, and I didn't get a good look at the play, but he plays so physical that I don't know if he's actually been flagged for one this year. So him getting flagged for one out of all those physical plays, it is what it is. But right after that, Ottaviano got tackled for a loss, and so that set up second and 31 on the first offensive drive. That's not great.
Nope.
Rice actually only had two full possessions in the first half because Marshall was controlling the ball so well on offense. So the second possession that with Giovanni at quarterback, 11 plays, 66 yards, drove him down the length of the field, touchdown. That went well. His third possession, and I'm not going to go break it all down drive by drive. You can find that in the piece, but got 2 yards on a third and three, but forced a punt, and then we got to the end of the half. And so you saw one full drive in the first half where you're like, I see it, and it worked. And in the second half, like, there was a missed field goal, and then he left two drives where he'd gotten Rice into Marshall territory, I guess, plus the 35 that he didn't get to finish because he left injured. And then you had another drive that ended up in first in 27 with a chalk block penalty, which, an aside, Rice is one of the least penalized teams in the nation still, but it feels like the penalties they do get happen at the most, not that there's an opportune time, but happen at the most inopportune times, especially on offense. So
yeah. So I mean, you look at that piece, and you definitely should if you haven't. And you come away with the impression that, and you kind of got this feeling watching the game. Like, I was sort of surprised when I went back and actually looked at the stats that his were what they were, because it felt better to me in the game. But when he actually got drives that weren't derailed by penalties or things like that, where there was actually a chance to sort of get things going, the offense ran pretty well. Like, they didn't do a lot of fancy stuff with him in the passing game. I mean, they haven't done a whole lot of fancy stuff in the passing game all year, so that wasn't a huge change. But for the most part, when, you know, they asked him to make throws, the ones they asked him to make, he was pretty good, pretty accurate. And obviously, he did a lot of damage with his legs. He did some on scrambles, some on some. And this is where you can look at the film room for this week. I highlighted two plays where he ran. They ran a power read with him that he took on the inside run and got a nice gain on. And then late in the game, the play that took him out of the game was a QB draw, an ISO play where they had the running back lead blocking for him. And he picked up some good yards on that play before getting the hit that eventually took him out of the game. But really, really effective as a runner, and you really like what you saw, and I like that they were diverse in the different things that they asked him to do. It wasn't all just, you know, run the same zone read play over and over again. So and he made good reads when they asked him to make the option reads, which is always nice to see, because I think I've highlighted this before, but that, you know, when I break down option run plays, when you just describe it, the process sounds so simple, like, you know, zone read. If the end crashes, you pull it. If the end stays home, you hand it off. Like, it sounds so simple, but making that read and making the correct decision in the moment is not an easy thing for quarterbacks to do. Like, you know, you think of one of the more famous running quarterbacks of all time in Tim Tebow, you know, who was so celebrated as a player in college and all that stuff, and was such a tough runner who, you know, that those shotgun option runs are such a foundation of Urban Meyer's offense. and Tebow ran them a ton. He actually wasn't particularly good at making those reads. Like, you could go back and highlight plenty of his career, his runs in his career where he pulled it or handed off when he maybe should have done the other thing. So I think that's kind of an unappreciated skill for a quarterback to have, particularly as a freshman who doesn't, you know, doesn't have that bank of experience to draw on. So I was really pleased to see Giovanni come in, and, you know, he had done that in limited action, but to see him come into the game and, you know, them ask him to execute these plays a bunch, and that he was consistently making the correct reads, I thought that was a really positive sign.
Yeah, by and large, if it felt like watching this game, the offense was better, even though you only saw them score, I guess they made the extra point this week, so one more point than the game prior. It was, and I think you can tell from just looking. There was a sequence, and I think this was some of the plays that you broke down, Carter, where Juma had a first down run, like 10 or 12 yard run. Then very next play, Giovanni had a 10 yard run. Then Juma had a 10 yard run. And I was trying to think in my head, and I didn't have time to go back and look this up, of whether or not Rice had had three plays with three successive first downs this season, because nothing immediately came to mind. Which, if you're talking about an offense that needs explosive plays and things like that, like, that was the answer, and that was what you were looking for. And we've talked a lot about Giovanni and what he was able to bring to the table. I think Juma being back in this offense, especially if you're going to put, so Juma Otaviano played quarterback in high school, and obviously so did Giovanni, and they're both very quick and very, very athletic and fast. You put both of those guys in the backfield together, the things that you can do as an offense, it looks a lot different than Tom Stewart or Wiley Green with Aston Walter or Charlie Booker. No offense to any of those. They both all had great plays in moments, but just the options and the flexibility that you have when you have Juma and Giovanni lined up next to each other, there's a whole lot of speed that can go a whole lot of places. And Giovanni can throw the ball.
Yeah. I mean, even like just you look at the unadjusted rushing numbers, 31 carries for 128 yards, so a little over 4 yards a carry. And, you know, you drop the sacks out of that, it ends up even being a little higher. So you end up with, even without a whole lot of a passing game, which they didn't have this game, but they haven't had a whole lot of passing game in a lot of games this year, the rushing numbers were a whole lot better. And it's just, it makes such a difference. One, when you've got a QB that, you know, for all that I respect the surprisingly great work that Tom Stewart has done in the QB run game this year, but when you've got a quarterback that can really, really run the ball, it just makes it so much easier to, because, you know, when you run these option plays, it just changes the numbers game. It's such a simple thing, but the numbers, running the ball is so much based on, can you get a hat on a hat? Do you have the numbers? And when you can run the quarterback or force them to account for the quarterback in the run game, it just changes it so much. And, you know, when you add in that Giovanni is such a good runner, and then you get Juma back, who, and, you know, this was the play I highlighted for him in the film room, but, you know, they just ran what looked like an inside zone to me, and they had two tight ends that were in line, so it was kind of 7-on-7 in the box. They had the numbers to get a hat on a hat, but I'm not going to point at someone and say this guy screwed up, because I don't know the assignments for sure. And so I don't want to blame a guy whose fault it wasn't. But it looked like there was some kind of error in the blocking, because they had seven guys to block seven, but ended up with a linebacker just totally free to sit in the gap and tackle Juma. And Juma just got in there and made a really nice cut. And the guy was caught kind of flat footed and had to lunge for him and completely whiffed on the tackle. And so, you know, sometimes you're just going to have plays where things don't go completely right, and you just need a guy, a ball carrier, to make something happen. And, you know, with all respect to guys like Aston and Charlie Booker and Deshaun Ellerby, Juma is just different. You know, it's very clear that he is the best playmaker or running back that this team has, I think. And so having him back and having Giovanni at quarterback, even though they weren't really able to do a whole lot through the air, it just made such a difference in the way the running game looked. It wasn't, you know, one of these ones like we've seen consistently over the weeks this year that where, you know, it was just kind of some 2 yard runs and some 3 yard runs and a loss of one and maybe you break one big one, but a generally inefficient run game like this, it just made such a difference having the running game being centered around those two guys and the option.
And I think because of that, so there was the running game looked different schematically as well. And so I don't, this didn't make a huge deal out of this going into the game last week, but as part of the changes that Mike Bloomgren and his staff kind of talked through on offense, part of the conscious decisions that they decided was Jerry Mack's roots are in more of a spread style offense, a lot closer to an air raid concept than what Bloomgren is bringing in from Stanford with, you know, the intellectual brutality and the three tight ends and then run the ball up the middle. What we saw this week was a bit more freedom from Bloomgren, from Mack to kind of do some things and change up the offense a little bit and kind of go back to some of the more of the spread concepts. And so we saw primarily Rice run out of 11 personnel, most of their plays, not even just the running plays, but pass plays and a lot of those different, you know, read options or things that there were a couple things that could flow from that. But having that set where you're taking away that extra tight end or that extra blocker, because there's two tight ends on the line. I mean, this isn't rocket science. The opposing defense is bringing an extra linebacker or a nickel or somebody else closer to the line of scrimmage. When you spread that guy out and you put him in the slot, that frees up and has one last man at the line of scrimmage more often than not and forces the defense to be more honest because there's less guys in the middle. And so Rice went from the previous several games trying to, you know, put eight guys in the middle and beat out eight guys to Rice tried to put on five or six guys in the middle and beat out five or six guys. And when you take out the numbers of defenders in the box, yards per carry goes up. That's universal across whoever the running back is or whoever the offense is. And then when you take into account that the running back is Juma, who has that kind of twitch that you alluded to, that someone can completely... Or a block can get missed and he can still score it out and give 15 yards. This offense looked and felt a lot different.
Yeah. And, you know, I love the one thing that stuck out to me was on that power read play that I highlighted where Giovanni kept the ball. They were in a shotgun two back set with a running back on either side of Giovanni. And it was Juma, who was the guy they actually ran the option game with, and then Asin on the right, who did kind of a, I'm not sure what you'd call that block. It's not an arc block because it's not coming all the way across. But he was essentially lead blocking for the outside run, which would have been Juma if the read had been give, and did a perfect cut block on the outside linebacker. I love those sets because you can do so many, like you keep the defense off guard because they don't know before the snap which running back the play is going to, and you can do all kind of lead stuff and you know, swing those guys out for passes. I think that those are really versatile packages that I think you can do a lot of stuff out of that are really fun. Alabama had a lot of success running that last year with Josh Jacobs and Damian Harris. But the other thing is, you know, you highlighted about, you know, getting guys out of the box, and that the way I think about that is that it's just you know, we've talked about earlier in the year with, you know, these plays where Rice is in 22 or 12 or you know, sometimes like 23 and 32 personnel, and you've got all these guys. You make it to where every one of those guys has to be perfect. Because if you've got eight blockers in the box, then they're going to have eight defenders in the box to try to beat you. And if all eight of your guys aren't perfect, then there's an unblocked guy who can tackle the running back. But if you've got five guys in the box blocking and you force them to spread out and get guys away so that they can only commit so many resources to stopping the run, then only five of your guys have to be perfect. If you get five perfect blocks on an eight-man box, you're probably getting a loss on the play. If you get five perfect blocks on a five-man box, then you're golden. So the way I think about that and why I'm, you know, if I were an offensive coordinator, this would be my kind of philosophy where you kind of want to spread guys out and run them over, is it just kind of it? You don't have such a big. It increases your margin for error because you have fewer guys that need to be perfect when you're running against light boxes.
Yeah, and I think kind of stepping back a little bit, the offense as a whole, I want to give credit to Blomgren and the staff because this it's pretty obvious at this point that what Mike Blomgren envisions this offense being, or at least when he got here and probably still in the long run, what Rice put on the field this past weekend was probably a lot different stylistically from what he'd envisioned, but I like it. And I like it because you could see signs of it being better and it having that spark that it really hasn't had since, I mean, definitely this season. And the willingness to change, and I mean, obviously everyone would have hoped that whatever the answer that results in wins would have been magically figured out 8 games ago versus if this was the answer against Marshall, or at least part of it. But I like to, and I want to give credit to Blomgren and his guys for going ahead and making that change, for because now there was a stretch last year, I think it was UAB and UTSA maybe, where Rice scored, I think, 6 points across 8 quarters, and the past 2 games Rice has 13 points across 8 quarters, which is not much of an improvement, but I feel so much better and more capable about the offense now because I've seen the staff adjust and make those changes and do things that I think tailor to the athletes that they have on the field.
Yeah, no, it's to me, one of the highest virtues in coaching is a willingness to change, to see when things aren't working and to be able to say, you know what, this is what I wanted to do. This is what I thought would work. It's not working. So I'm not going to keep beating my head on against the wall. I'm going to change things around and do what my guys need to be in order to be successful.
And, which, you know, to make a Conference USA and an Alabama tie-in to bring this all together, if you look at we have, of course, this upcoming weekend we have Alabama, which Rice is off, so you can watch some of these games. Alabama LSU this upcoming weekend, which a game that there might be 100 points scored, which looks a lot different from the 9-6 game a couple years ago. And credit with Nick Saban with this, bringing in Lane Kiffin, now Conference USA FAU head coach, to install a much more spread, wide open passing attack. And the Alabama that you're going to see take the field this weekend or all year has 4 of the best wide receivers in the nation and one of the best quarterbacks, if not the best, who can get the ball to him. And that looks a lot different than, I mean, Jake Coker lining up under center.
Oh, Jake.
Personnel.
Jake was a nice boy. After they got back from the national championship that year, I was in Tuscaloosa, and I ran into Jake in the parking lot, and I told him Roll Tide, and he said Roll Tide back.
There you go. So, an aside, even the best coaches and the best programs, that is what makes them some of the best coaches and the best programs, the ability to adjust and change. And who knows if Rice can get all the personnel and things sorted out. I don't think the end of hard-nosed running has come to South Main. I don't think we're all of a sudden going to see a spread team take the field in 2020. That's probably not going to be the case, but I think we've seen enough to know that there can be some tweaks to figure out the hybrid system that works for the time being and hopefully lead to some more wins and help out that defense more than anything.
Well, you know, and in some sense, I think it's, and I touched on this a bit last week when we were talking about the, you know, this offensive change as more of a hypothetical future thing and wondering what it was kind of going to look like. But I give a lot of credit to Bloom for hiring Jerry Mack in the first place. Like, you know, if he was incredibly dedicated to keeping the system that he had run at Stanford and to that was going to be the vision for the future no matter what, even if there were some growing pains at first, it would have been easy for him to to hire a guy who had run a system like that to maybe bring another guy over from Stanford to be his offensive coordinator. But I think the fact that he brought in Jerry as the coordinator to begin with, you know, kind of signals that he was aware from the beginning that there was going to be a need to run some of this kind of stuff from a practical perspective, if nothing else, because, you know, you think about even as he has kind of nationalized the recruiting for Rice, which I love, I thought was the right move all along. I'm really happy that they're doing that. But, you know, the bulk of your talent is still going to come from Texas. And everybody in Texas runs spread passing offenses. So, you know, in some sense, you want to just be able to do what your recruits are good at doing already. But I think the fact that he had the foresight coming in to hire a guy like Jerry Mack with that background, you know, signaled an awareness that it was going to be necessary to do some of this stuff. And, you know, I give him credit, and I give both of them credit for putting together this kind of hybrid offense. But, you know, the knowledge beforehand that some of this was going to maybe be necessary, I think, is a credit as well.
Yes, and now we've seen a taste of it, and we need to see the next step.
Right.
And I guess, so broaching that next step conversation, we might have an interesting situation at quarterback once we get off of the bye week. So, as we mentioned, Giovanni in the second half was going through, ripped off a pretty big run, and then got hit. He needs to work on his sliding and making sure that if he is as talented as he has, we have him for a full four quarters. But on that play, not sure exactly what it was. I think it might have been an ankle or a foot injury of some sort. So he was in a boot at practice this week, but positive news is it's looking that is a precautionary measure to some point, and with the off week that ahead of us, it's optimistic, and it's looking like he's going to be available for the Middle Tennessee game. That's November 16th, so I guess a week and a half from now, which is good news. And Tom Stewart is looking like he's close to 100% as he's going to be this season. And I mean, I was out of practice and threw a couple pretty good deep balls and moved pretty well for somebody who is not able to get out of bed a couple weeks ago with his back pain. So there is a high likelihood that when Rice takes the field next, they will have a mostly healthy, maybe not 100% healthy Tom Stewart, and a mostly healthy Giovanni Johnson, who has played in three games and has one more game before he will have to give up his red shirt for the season. So, I guess the question is, what does Rice do?
Yeah.
The confidence.
I'll say I don't envy the coaching staff on this one, because there are real downsides to both possible decisions here, and it's easy to see both sides of the argument, right? Because, you know, we've just sat here talking about what a spark he brought to the offense, and you figure he's only going to get better with time, and so here's a guy who I think it's pretty clear has the highest ceiling of any quarterback on the team, is a guy who we've talked about from fall camp as a guy to watch, who just came in and, you know, had some growing pains as a freshman, but looked pretty good in his first start. And so in some sense, how do you say this is the best guy we've got and we're not going to play him in, you know, the three remaining games we have this season? We're just going to kind of, I don't know, give up on two of those and play him against UTEP and preserve that red shirt. But on the flip side, like, it's not like you're going to make him.
If he is as good as he looked as he was, then that extra year sure would be nice.
Right. And are you going to, you know, there's no guarantee they beat North Texas or, I've gone totally blank, Middle Tennessee. Is that the other team they have left?
Besides UTEP? That's correct. Next up.
Yeah. Like, there's a good chance you don't beat those teams even with him. So, you know, are you going to burn the guy's red shirt and lose a whole year of him to be slightly more competitive against Middle Tennessee and North Texas? Are you going to give up a whole year of him to maybe get a 3-9 season instead of a 1-11 season?
And it's interesting because
it's a tough decision.
I won't pretend that I have the right answer, but if we step back 2 years to the red shirt rule as it used to be, that if you play in a game, your shirt's gone, and that season doesn't get rolled over to the next year, I think you can make a real argument that Giovanni Johnson, from what we've seen from him in limited action, was worth playing this year. Like, he did enough through fall camp and through practices and what we saw against Marshall that not having him play this year would not have been the optimal decision to give Rice the best opportunity to win football games. So I realize that the redshirt rule is different now, and that you, instead of playing that one game, you can play four. But if you told me that Giovanni was going to play this year and he gave Rice a chance to win football games, then I know, like, in the perfect world, then yeah, Giovanni would have either played 12 or four. He wouldn't have played six. But in the world that we are now, where you have a quarterback that has turnover issues that has cost you games, and you have another quarterback who has back problems, which is challenging when 250-pound men are tackling you and hitting you in the pocket. Like, the world that we are in right now, like, if the answer going forward is Giovanni gives us our best chance, then I don't have any problem whatsoever with Giovanni playing the remainder of the string and starting the remainder three games. I know that's burning his red shirt, but if I'm in those shoes at South Maine, I care a lot more about wins right now in 2019 than whoever is starting for me at quarterback. And what would Giovanni's senior year be, 2019, 2022? Is that right? Like, you got to have enough confidence.
Yeah, I mean, if he had a redshirt year, it would be 2023.
Right. But even without, you got to have enough confidence in yourself as a recruiting department and a coaching staff that you can find another quarterback that can start for you in 2022. Like, so it's not optimal, but I could see that decision being made, and I would be behind it, I think.
Yeah. And you think about it, like, think about the equivalent for a guy like Trishon DeBones, who has come on and started this past game and played pretty well, but before that had been, you know, if he hadn't played at all up until now, he could have come in this game and played this game in the last three and kept his red shirt. And up until now, he had just been playing as a reserve. So, you know, is playing a quarterback in spot duty and then starting him in four games and losing his red shirt that way, is it really that different than playing a freshman corner in purely reserve action and on special teams and stuff like that, where he's not going to make a huge impact on the game in those roles, and then playing him, you know, starting him in a couple games because of an injury? Like, I don't feel like those scenarios are all that different, and yet we don't bat an eye at burning a guy's red shirt in the circumstances that Trishon DeBones is in. So.
He's not a quarterback, and that is the caveat and the difference, sure, and why this becomes a big deal.
But you know, like, I think bringing up the uncertainty for, you know, 2022, 2023, like, you don't know. I mean, you know, I'll knock on wood and not cast bad luck on the guy, but, you know, he could have an injury that ends his playing career. He could have some personal circumstances that make him transfer home. He could decide to grad transfer or something, like, oh, I don't know. Transfer home. I don't actually know where Giovanni's from, but, you know, he could have a personal circumstances. Yeah, that makes him say want to transfer to Central Arkansas or Arkansas State or something like that. You know, you just never know. So saying, like, we're going to sacrifice a competitive chance in these last couple games for the sake of 2023 is kind of a hard sell. On the flip side, though, they kind of did this exact thing with Wiley last year.
They did the exact same thing with Wiley last year. So what happened in those circumstances were Sean Stankavage, the starter, he got hurt, went down. They went to Evan Marshman. He got hurt and went down, and they went to Wiley. And then at that point, it looked like Sean Stankavage's injury was going to be season and career ending, to the point where, you know, we kind of out of sight, out of mind, then lo and behold, I think, three games left into the season after Wiley had appeared in three games, if that's right, I think it is. Sean came in and started two games before ceding to Wiley to kind of finish things off. So it was almost to the T, the exact same scenario. So you could argue that if Tom is healthy enough to go and operate at a high level, then you could see the staff, were they to make the same decision, Tom would start against Middle and North Texas, and then you'd see Giovanni come in for the finale against UTEP. So we were in the situation. We saw what the staff did. It's different in year zero, year one, than I think year two. So we'll see. I know that they're pretty cognizant about not bowing to pressure or feeling too much heat from what fans or people talking on the internet might think. So I am sure they've had those discussions internally, and I don't know what they'll come up to. But it'll be an interesting situation to monitor. I think we are all going to have our eyes glued to whoever trots out on the field against Middle for sure, and then even more so maybe against North Texas in 2 weeks from now.
I don't know. I was saying all before about what a tough decision it is, and I just honestly, this is not me, I don't know, trying to be deferential to the staff or put on any kind of smokescreen here. I legitimately am not sure I have a preference here. Like, I think it's a completely understandable decision either way, and I will not be... I'm at the point where I feel like Giovanni is the best quarterback for this program going forward, so I will be kind of hopeful to see him take a next step and take the job in 2020. But at this point, do I think whether or not he plays in these two upcoming games makes a huge difference in the amount of development? Probably not. So...
Well, and here's the caveat of process versus results, right? There's a world where Tom Stewart starts the next two games and Rice wins both games and Giovanni comes in and beats UTEP. And voila, not playing Giovanni was the right decision. And then there's a world where Giovanni starts the next two games and they don't win. And then his red shirt is gone and you're looking at a zero win, one win season. But neither of those, like we discussed earlier in the pod, make it the right decision to redshirt or not redshirt him. We're not going to know that for at least through the off season and into next fall before we really see the after effects of that. So, like you said, I'm glad that I don't have to be the one that sits in the room and actually decides who takes the first snap.
Yep.
Of any game, that at all. Matter.
Yeah. I will be very interested. Won't be disappointed either way, because again, I think there's really a really understandable logical thought process behind either decision. So, but we will definitely be watching that come 2 weeks against North Texas.
Middle. And then before we spend too much, I think we've covered offense a lot. A couple things on the defensive side of the ball, since we kind of opened things up with talking about how impressive they were. I want to give another tip of the hat to Naeem Smith, second on the team in tackles. The first game, the last three, he did not have an interception, but a heck of a find from the JUCO ranks. He has been absolutely spectacular. Had a feeling entering the fall that he would be, but he's had an incredible year.
Yeah, him and Brad Rosner both, two really, really great JUCO finds for this staff, for a program that has not generally and probably is not going to a ton going forward taken a lot of JUCOs. But hats off to the recruiting staff for finding those guys and getting them in, because that's
you talk about those two and Blaze, another JUCO guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, arguably you're talking about, I don't know, three of the top 10 conservatively players on the team right now that you pulled from JUCO. and you got into Rice?
Yeah.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. So good find there. And then Antonio Montero, 11 tackles. Blaze had only 8, but added 2 more tackles for a loss and a sack. I don't know what that total is up there, but he's getting closer to, I think, Larry Izzo's tackle for a loss record at Rice, and still among the top 5 in the nation in tackles for a loss. So watching him and Montero is just fun. Like, there's no other word about it. Like, opposing offenses are really struggling, and it's because of what they've been able to do over the middle. And then one more linebacker, Garrett Grammer, which this dude, I mean, I mentioned how they were fun to watch. So Marshall comes out and tries to run a reverse, and Garrett comes out like a cannon and chases him down, tackles him in the backfield for a loss, coming off the UTSA game where he was the only guy on special teams to catch and diagnose a fake punt and stop that in the backfield for a loss and turnover on fourth down. So I don't know if he, Sherlock Grammer, able to diagnose trick plays when everybody else might be fooled, but shoot, you'd think if you're an offense, you want to run your trick plays and your things that are complicated when your starting linebackers are not on the field, but that might not matter if Rice is bringing in Garrett to clean things up.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's always fun to watch any time a fake or a trick play is run like that, and there's a linebacker. It always seems to be a linebacker who is not fooled from the beginning and just completely blows the play up. And you know, credit to Garrett in a pretty limited role for doing that now in successive weeks. So yeah, it's been fun to watch. All right, I think that may be it for this week. You got anything else?
Yep, there's a couple guys that are or have been beat up. So go ahead and stick around. Oh, yeah. Make sure you go check out the website this week for practice reports, and we'll hit as much as we can on the podcast next week before we get into previewing the middle game. But it's looking like, fingers crossed, we might get Anthony Ekpe back. He's been out for 3 or 4 weeks now at this point, and Ken Hardy's been pretty solid in his place, but getting that kind of disruption off the edge would be a huge plus. Andrew Byrd is closer, and especially with the off week, I'm kind of optimistic that if we don't see him against Middle, we could get him back against North Texas. There's a couple guys like that that have just been banged up in and out of the lineup this year that I think this bye week, weird schedule having 2 bye weeks, but when they were, I don't think you could have asked for better for Rice. So this will be a plus, especially with the last 3 games being very winnable. It would help to have a healthy roster back. So stay tuned on the website, and we'll cover as much as we can those injuries as we get that news in. I think that's all we got this week.
All right. Well, we will be back and see y'all next week. Thanks for sticking with us, and Rice fight.
This show was edited and produced by Carter Spires. It features music from Joseph McDade.